You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, researchers at UW-Madison are part of a select group that will be studying the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19. We'll find out what they're looking for and the story of how a campus lab got a sample of the virus in the first place. First, a few items currently up for grabs in Appleton, free of charge. A bowling ball, shoes, and carrying bag, a big box full of individual Mandarin Orange snack cups, or there are several choices in electric organs. If you're in southern Wisconsin, someone's looking for a home for their 32-year-old collection of model railroader magazines. Someone else is offering up their mobile cat-scratching unit, which is actually just a pretty destroyed office chair. All that and more could be yours thanks to the power of Craigslist. For 25 years, Craigslist has been the internet's classified ad section, helping people buy and sell cars, find furniture after moving, sell their handmade items, or find a job. And unlike many of the sites or places we spend time on the internet, not much has changed in its look or its use. Jessa Lingle is an assistant professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies digital culture, looking for the ways that relationships to technology can show us gaps in power or possibilities for social change. Her new book is called An Internet for the People, The Politics and Promise of Craigslist. Jessa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, first, I imagine if you wrote a book on Craigslist, you might have used it a time or two. How have your personal experiences influenced you writing this book?
Yeah, in my family, I'm definitely known as the person who will buy or sell anything on Craigslist. So a lot of my furniture, my bike, my cell phone, I even have a ficus tree that I got on Craigslist. And that's been in many different cities that I've lived. And I've always had really positive experiences. And the main thing that happened when I wrote the book is just I learned so much more about this platform that I had always sort of enjoyed using and meeting different people and seeing different parts of the cities where I've lived. And now I just really know so much more about its history and its backstory and its politics.
Going back to the mid-1990s, a lot has changed since then on the internet. The big sites, a lot of them have fallen. Others have changed a lot over the times. And then there's Craigslist. It's been around all this time, and people say it hasn't really changed that much in terms of how it looks. What accounts for its staying power?
Yeah, it hasn't changed very much in terms of how it looks. If you can't really play that sort of game about how websites transform over time with Craigslist, because it really looks the same now as it did in like 2008. And the main reason for that is that it also hasn't changed in terms of its leadership. So there is a Craig behind Craigslist, Craig Newmark. He's still, fairly involved in the company. And then they've had the same CEO, Jim Buckmaster, since 1999. And the two of them just really believe in this early 1990s web ethic of, don't fix something that's not broken, keep it simple, keep it working. So they're just really committed to keeping the website how it is.
For people, a lot of people have used Craigslist, Jessa, but for those who haven't, how do you describe it?
It is, it's all the simplicity of the classified section of a newspaper that is just online and free to use. So if you ever wrote an old school, classified ad in a newspaper, you had to be very careful about the number of characters that you used, and you had to usually pay amount of money. And then for Craigslist, most ads are free, and you could make those ads as descriptive as you wanted, for better or worse.
And as you write, not everyone knows exactly what they're using when they use Craigslist. Some people think it's a local thing or it's a nonprofit thing. This is actually a money-making joint, right?
Absolutely. So it's the most successful platform in any medium at any point in history for classified ads. And we don't know exactly how much it makes because it's privately held. But, estimates run up as much as $1 billion or $2 billion. And it pulls in, a bunch of money every year. And it's a very well-visited site. So Craigslist gets more monthly visitors than the New York Times or ESPN.com. So it's incredibly popular and very much profitable.
There are big concerns about a lot of the big sites, the Facebooks of the world, for example, and what they're doing with our data. Are there similar concerns with something like Craigslist?
So not really, partly because on Craigslist, you're anonymous by default. So when you put up an ad, you could certainly say, this is my name and here's my phone number, or you can not say that and you don't really have to share any details about yourself that you don't want to. So there's a lot that Craigslist doesn't know about you simply because it doesn't ask information about you. And then on top of that, Craigslist does not sell data to third parties. So it's not gathering data in order to help marketers sell targeted ads or anything like that. It makes all its money from a small number of ads that they charge for, which are mostly job ads and real estate ads in certain cities. So it's a very different business model than companies that really feel free when you're using them. But actually, that's because the product is you.
Jessa Lingle is with us. Her book is called An Internet for the People, The Politics and Promise of Craigslist. Beyond just looking at the specifics of how Craigslist work, Jessa, you use it as kind of a model for a different way of thinking about the internet than we do nowadays. What do you think we could learn from a site like this about how it interacts with its users?
So I think for one thing, we can realize that you don't have to turn users into data in order to make a profit, that you can actually respect users' privacy and still find ways to make money as a website. So company doesn't really have to choose between being a nonprofit and respecting privacy. They can actually have their cake and eat it too in that sense. So that's one thing. And then another thing is you really don't have to change your platform all the time. So in Silicon Valley, there's this sort of mantra of you got to move fast and break things. You can't get left behind. You got to constantly change your appearance, you got to have new features, and Craigslist just has never bought that. And instead, they say, like, we're going to keep the same appearance, we're not really going to change our features too much. And they've done quite well for themselves.
Now, not everything has been rosy over the years. There was controversy over the personals section of Craigslist, concerns that it was being used for prostitution and possibly for sex trafficking. Can you talk about that chapter in the Craigslist history?
Sure. It's a long chapter. So Craigslist got its start in San Francisco, which is why it's always had this sort of liberal politics around, you know, sex and around identity. And so it has always supported sex workers sort of quite actively on the platform. And that really started to change in 2009. There was a high profile series of crimes that were connected to Craigslist, and a bunch of state attorneys general across the country sort of went on the warpath. And over time, Craigslist has sort of changed its policies, made it harder and harder for sex workers to use the platform. And then that all came to an end in 2018 when Congress passed a law called FOSTA, which holds platforms accountable for sex trafficking. And there's just no way to make sure that an anonymous ad about, you know, adult services is a genuine ad of someone who wants to do that versus someone who's trafficked. I think the thing to know is, like, Craigslist has definitely had its battles on this topic, but so have other platforms. So everything from Facebook to Backpages.com, even platforms like LinkedIn have been connected to human trafficking. So it's a much bigger problem than any one platform.
Now, on a maybe less serious note, one of the benefits of Craigslist is that it allows you to, you know, interact directly with randomly selected people from your area and around the state. One of the downsides is you're interacting with randomly selected people. What are some of the difficulties, mild up to serious, that people encounter because they're just meeting random people on Craigslist?
Yeah, I mean, so it can be kind of delightful. I literally bought a phone last night on Craigslist and in my neighborhood, and I knocked on the door, and then you know, I live in South Philadelphia, and then it turned out they had converted their coffee table into like a rabbit hutch. So there were like these rabbits in the apartment. It was just like completely unexpected. I had no idea that was going on in my neighborhood. So that kind of thing is, you know, fun and a little bit quirky, but it's, you also have to be smart. You know, I went with my dog. You know, you have to take precautions to sort of feel safe and make sure that you're acting safely. At the same time, I want to point out, like, for a lot of people I spoke with, a lot of people who are poor or live in poor neighborhoods, a lot of people of color, they talked about Craigslist and its policies around anonymity being a form of privacy that they really appreciated. So you can't really discriminate against someone on Craigslist because you don't know their name, you don't know anything about them. You can sort of make sure that this way your neighbors don't know that you're selling a TV or selling something expensive. So a lot of people see the downsides of Craigslist, but for another group of people, for people who are have different privacy concerns, the platform also provides a form of safety.
In our last few moments, Jessa, you do see some good in the model that Craigslist uses. Is it an anomaly, though, or do you see these lessons being taken and used elsewhere?
Yeah, I don't want the the whole internet to look like Craigslist. Like that's not my dream for the web, but I do think there's important lessons that we can learn. And so I do think that there are other companies that have really learned, you know, how to cooperate more with law enforcement, how to think differently about user privacy. Craigslist and eBay have had a very fraught relationship, but I also think they've learned from each other about how to treat users and how to manage scams. So I do think that Craigslist isn't just a quirky corner of the internet. It's also a really important testament to how the internet feels like it changes all the time, but can actually stay the same too.
Jessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jessa Lingle, an assistant professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Her new book is called An Internet for the People, The Politics and Promise of Craigslist. Coming up next, we'll get an inside look at how UW-Madison researchers got a sample of the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19, and we'll find out about some of the safety precautions that go into studying this kind of potentially dangerous pathogen. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, last night's Super Tuesday results put Joe Biden ahead of Bernie Sanders in the Democratic presidential primary, but some results are still on the way. We'll look at the numbers and what's starting to look like it's going to be a two-person race. First, as governments and international bodies continue to respond to the novel coronavirus, researchers around the world are racing to learn more about how it works and how to treat it. Those efforts include research at UW-Madison, which has two separate teams studying the pathogen that causes COVID-19. Our colleagues over at WisContext recently took a closer look at those efforts, including the story of how one UW researcher got a hold of a coronavirus sample and how samples like this are handled for safety purposes. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keeley Baltina yesterday.
Thanks for having me.
We've got two big words at play here that might be unfamiliar to people. They were to me. We've got COVID-19, which is a respiratory disease. And then there's SARS-CoV-2, which is actually the pathogen itself that causes the disease. Break that down for us.
Exactly. Well, you just did a really good job. So SARS-CoV-2 is the name of the actual virus that causes this disease, the virus that emerged in central China the end of last year of 2019. And it causes a disease known as COVID-19, 19 being a reference to 2019.
Okay, so which of the two is UW-Madison then focusing research on?
The researchers at UW-Madison are focusing on the virus itself, so on SARS-CoV-2. Ultimately, they're interested in the disease, but to understand the disease, the researchers have to understand the virus that causes it.
And we have two research efforts then around this particular pathogen at UW-Madison. So what's happening with what Thomas Friedrich and Dave O'Connor are doing?
Those two researchers are collaborating with colleagues at other institutions as well. So they haven't taken receipt of a sample of the virus here in Madison. They're hoping that some of their colleagues at other institutions will be able to. They're going to be researching, hopefully, a whole bunch of things, but they're particularly interested in, or one of the things that they're particularly interested in is how a virus like SARS-CoV-2, which is believed to have originated in an animal species, how a virus like that makes the jump to humans, because there are a plethora of viruses that affect animal species that don't affect humans. And every once in a while, something like SARS-CoV-2 comes around that starts infecting humans and then becomes widely transmissible between humans. And they just want to understand why that is or how that happens.
Okay, so there's that transition that is one focus of the research. And then there's research from Yoshihiro Kawaoka. Tell us who he is, what he's worked on in the past, where we're going now.
Yeah, Kawaoka is a really pretty prominent researcher at UW-Madison. He's well known for his studies on influenza, really dangerous subtypes of influenza.
Right, a little bit controversial.
Yeah, sometimes they have been, yep. There are some other prominent virologists and scientists who have taken issue with some of his experiments in the past. He's also focused some work on Ebola as well. But he has actually has a sample of the virus that he was able to get from the patient in Dane County, the one confirmed case here in Wisconsin, via UW hospitals where that patient was diagnosed. And he's interested in also a whole bunch of things, but particularly he wants to identify a good animal model for this virus. So he wants to identify a lab animal that exhibits similar symptoms to once infected with this virus as a human would. So that allows for experiments that you could look at a whole bunch of things and kind of use these animal models as a proxy for understanding the infection in humans.
And we should say that the patient with COVID-19 in Wisconsin has recovered, was released from the hospital last week. But on getting the sample, is that way of retrieving the sample and getting it to the lab anyway unusual, or is this how business is done?
It's not. Yeah. So I was really interested in this. Like, how does this happen when a patient is infected with a rare and dangerous disease? Like, how does a sample of that virus make its way into a lab?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily super unusual, but it does involve a whole bunch of hoops to jump through. Regulatory and ethical standards need to be upheld. And it is unusual in the case of SARS-CoV-2 right now, the way that Kouoka was able to get the virus directly from UW hospitals. Most researchers in the nation right now who are studying the virus or hope to study the virus are they have to get a sample of the virus from a contractor for NIH based in Virginia.
And it sounds like those samples are not widely available right now.
No. Based on the website of this contractor, it sounds like labs that want a specimen of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, they're telling them to expect maybe to be able to get 2 specimens per year per lab at this point, and they're not providing like a timeline for when the virus would be widely available or shipped to individual labs.
Right. The phrase "we cannot guarantee" shows up there.
Exactly.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of Wiscontext, and we are talking about research into a novel coronavirus that's happening here at UW-Madison. And Will, this is a dangerous pathogen. We've seen how fast it's spreading and people have died. How do we know that the research happening here in Wisconsin is safe?
That's a really good question. And that was kind of like the meat of that was the main question I wanted to answer in my reporting as well. And there are, I feel assured after talking to a whole bunch of people involved that this research is being conducted really safely. It started out with Dr. Kouoka needed to provide a protocol. He needed to tell UW Hospital what research he intended to do, and vouch for the safety practices and the biocontainment, biosafety practices in his lab. He had to assure the hospital that the confidentiality of the patient who was infected with the virus would remain confidential. He had to jump through a whole bunch of hoops in order to even get approval to get a sample of this virus. That approval had to come from the institutional review boards on campus, which make sure that research that involves medical research that involves human subjects, not only medical research, but in this case, medical research, adheres to national and state regulations and high ethical standards. And then on top of that, there's a whole bunch of shipping regulations. Sometimes people who ship these dangerous pathogens have to be trained and certified. There's regulations from the DOT. Sometimes you have to get special permits to ship viruses such as SARS-CoV-2, even between labs on an individual campus, which was the case here.
It sounds like it is a lot of work, and maybe even some people would call it red tape. But with such a dangerous organism that we're dealing with, it's really important that this is followed, because otherwise people could get sick.
Yeah, exactly. So the SARS-CoV-2 virus, while it causes mild to moderate symptoms in most people, is really dangerous for a small minority of people and is fatal in some instances. So in cases like that, researchers obviously feel the need to be extra cautious with it, as do the people who house those specimens, hospitals, et cetera.
Right. These medical professionals, these researchers understand the responsibility they have.
Precisely.
And what other takeaways should we bring with us from the reporting that you've done about how UW-Madison is now connected to this global almost pandemic as we're sitting with the WHO here?
I think it's the fact that there was a patient with a confirmed diagnosis in Wisconsin so early on in this outbreak was like a minor moment of like scientific serendipity for these local researchers who suddenly had another place to gain access to this virus and didn't necessarily have to go through the NIH contractor. So it provided when in a case like this, when the race to understand everything we can about this emerging virus is like really urgent, it's really quite, I think, fascinating, and I think Wisconsinites should be assured that like the research that's happening here is of a global importance.
And with the global importance and really on the cutting edge of this, do we have any idea when we might start to see some of the findings of the research?
We don't. Yeah. I would assume as soon as possible. But that said, the scientific process, when it's done correctly, takes time. We've already seen Reuters actually did a big look at all of the scientific studies that have come out so far related to the virus. A whole lot of them have not been peer reviewed, and a whole lot of those have had pretty major problems. So science that is conducted correctly takes time and requires that peer review process.
All right. We'll pay attention and check in again. Will, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor at WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keeley Boltina about research efforts at UW-Madison to study the novel coronavirus. You can read the story online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, Joe Biden scored some big wins in last night's Super Tuesday primaries, but some results are still coming in. We'll break down what happened and the state of the race from here on out. It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics, Super Tuesday edition. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers has been busy at the Capitol with a string of recent bills either signed into law or vetoed. We'll break down some of the latest with WPR's state Capitol reporter. First, 14 states and one U.S. territory held Democratic primary elections yesterday after a busy few days in the race to be the nominee for president. Former Vice President Joe Biden won 10 states to grab a lead in the number of pledged delegates. He got a boost when Pete Buttigieg and Senator Amy Klobuchar dropped out of the race and endorsed him earlier in the week. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won 3 states last night and is expected to win California, where results are still coming in. Mike Bloomberg dropped out of the race today, and Senator Elizabeth Warren is reportedly reassessing her campaign, potentially making the primary effectively a two-person contest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the results we have so far from yesterday's primary results? If you plan to vote Democratic, are you relieved that the field is narrowed to leave Joe Biden as the one moderate candidate? Or do you think a more progressive platform than Biden's is needed to win the general election? If you're an independent voter, a Republican, how are you looking at all of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob, how are you?
Good. You're getting a lot of Ideas Network time. You were on with our friends on 1A earlier today, but I know you saved the good stuff for us, right?
Of course. Of course.
Well, let's look at some of the latest developments before we look at the big picture. California, and we knew this coming in, California takes a while to tally all the ballots. You can your vote, I think, is counted if you mail it in on Election Day. So they're still going to be coming in by the end of the week. What are we looking for in California right now?
That's right. The Secretary of State out there, Alex Padilla, even put out a statement last week effectively saying, calm down. We know we're going to count slowly. Counties have until tomorrow to even tell the state how many ballots they have left to count. So there could be millions of ballots out there. Even though there are 87% of precincts reporting, counties are still going to have millions of ballots to count. At the moment, Bernie Sanders has a reasonably healthy lead out there. He's ahead of former Vice President Joe Biden by 9%. Percentage points, 34-25. But I expect those numbers to narrow as more ballots are counted, largely because the similar theme that we saw all across Super Tuesday last night was that the people who waited to decide until the very last minute favored Joe Biden by a pretty substantial margin. In California, it was a 2-1 margin. 44% of late deciding voters backed Biden, 22% backed Sanders. Sanders won the state because he has such a well of supporters who voted early and had decided, you know, weeks or months ago that he was their candidate. And so they never wavered. But it's pretty clear that the last 72 hours or so changed this entire campaign after Joe Biden's unexpectedly large win in the South Carolina Democratic primary, which in itself came from a late endorsement from Jim Clyburn, the Democratic House Majority Whip there, who is basically the senior statesman in South Carolina. So he vaulted everything forward and has given Biden this wind in his sails that I don't think any of us would have expected even a week ago.
I think probably analysts are going to be digging into the numbers and the exit polls for months, probably years to come on this. But Reid, anything striking you about who voted and who they voted for from what we know from yesterday so far?
Well, one of the things that I took away was this was really a moment in which black voters in particular reasserted their control over the Democratic primary. Biden and Sanders in a lot of states fought to about a draw with white voters. Sanders would typically win the younger voters. Biden would win the older voters. But in state after state, Biden's winning margin came from African-American voters who know him and trust him for so long. I mean, I think a lot of people rolled their eyes when they heard the Biden campaign talk about South Carolina as their firewall when black voters first got involved. But they were right. And they have benefited from that in states like Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Alabama, and Arkansas, all states that Biden won, all states where African-American voters play a huge role. And by the way, that's going to matter going forward because the next round of primaries in Michigan, Mississippi, and Missouri, and Washington State, I should say my home state, are all at least four of those places, or three of those four places, are places where African-American voters play a disproportionate role in the Democratic primary.
Talking to Reid Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, looking at Super Tuesday and what came out of it. Want to give a listen to the two front runners now. First of all, former Vice President Joe Biden talking to supporters last night.
We want a nominee who will beat Donald Trump, but also keep Nancy Pelosi the Speaker of the House, win back the United States Senate. If that's what you want, join us. And if you want a nominee who's a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, a proud Democrat, an Obama-Biden Democrat, join us.
Then let's give a listen to Senator Bernie Sanders speaking in Vermont yesterday.
You cannot beat Trump with the same old kind of politics. What we need is a new politics that brings working class people into our political movement, which brings young people into our political movement.
And Reid, in those two quotes there, that seems to sum up the likely line of debate, doesn't it, between the two candidates?
Yeah, Joe Biden is going to present himself as the calm and stable, experienced person who can be ready for the job on day one, and who will not pitch the Sanders policies that he's railed against, including Medicare for All. Biden has questioned how Sanders would pay for that. One thing I'd pay attention to, though, Biden has also taken a few early shots at Sanders' record on gun control. And for as liberal as Sanders is, Vermont is a pretty pro-Second Amendment state, if you will, and Sanders has not always been embraced sort of gun control that is now the standard position within the Democratic Party. So I expect Joe Biden to make that a real line of attack. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders is going to make the case that Joe Biden is a reversion to the status quo, as you heard him say. And that's something that that Biden is I mean, clearly he is the insider's insider candidate as of now. We'll see whether or not that attack sticks. The troubling part for Sanders, if I were on the Sanders campaign, is that I don't see a lot of evidence that he's growing his base, that he's growing his electoral coalition. In every state last night, his percentage of the vote was down compared to where it was in 2016, even in his home state of Vermont. He won about 51% of Vermont voters last night, or Vermont Democrats last night. In 2016, he won 86% of the vote. So that tells me that Sanders needs to do some addition here if he's going to have a successful electoral coalition going ahead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hello.
Hi. You know, if Joe Biden is the nominee, and it looks like he will be, and I just want to say for the record, not my pick, but at that point, the Democrats should absolutely have no debates against Trump, because Trump is going to walk all over Biden. And all of us Democrats leaning Democrats have promised to vote blue no matter who. So they should just skip over, you know, all the chances that Biden has to mess things up and just carry on with the election.
Chris, thanks for the call. Not a lot of confidence from Chris, a Democratic-leaning voter. She identifies. Reed, what do you think?
Well, first of all, the race isn't over yet. Don't forget that Wisconsin gets to vote on April 7th, and a whole bunch of other states get to go both before and after them. So there we go, long way to go. But yeah, that's been the knock on Biden. He was the front runner at the beginning of this. He turned in some pretty weak performances on the debate stage early on, and took some the slings and arrows that a front runner always does from some of his rival candidates. On the other hand, he's had a couple of pretty good debate performances in both. Before Nevada and before South Carolina's primaries, and he has given some pretty well received speeches as he has won these two races. So, you know, Biden it is clearly a knock on him that he does not perform as well on the debate stage as some of his other Democratic rivals. Let's see, though, because in previous presidential campaigns, the incumbent president has a real tough time dealing with a challenger in their first debates, and that's largely because, you know, they haven't been on stage with an equal for 4 years. There is no one equal to the president of the United States unless you're his opponent and debating him in a debate. So, I mean, I remember, you know, Mitt Romney wiped the floor with Barack Obama so much that Obama apologized to his advisors and supporters in the hours afterwards. John Kerry had a really strong first debate against George W. Bush. So, you know, that is going to be a factor when President Trump finally stands next to an equal on a debate stage.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We're going now to Tom in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi, my question is this. I've spoken to some Bernie Sanders people, and can Joe Biden win if they alienate the Bernie Sanders people who are not necessarily traditional Democrat voters?
Tom, thanks for the call. A concern for Democrats, again, in the scenario where Joe Biden wins, which is not 100%, certainly read that concern that some Bernie Sanders voters effectively stay home on Election Day.
Yeah, that's something that we've heard a lot, especially after the 2016 race. It's certainly possible. There are Sanders people who are so committed to their candidate that they can't stomach the notion of voting for anybody else. And I'd say there are probably Biden people who can't stomach the notion of voting for anybody else either. The question is, how will the party come together in the months after an actual nominee is chosen and a convention happens? One thing I would point to is that Barack Obama has been pointedly absent from the debate stage, absent from the conversation about who the nominee should be. And that's largely because he sees his role after this primary of bringing together a party and unifying it as much as possible. We'll see if that happens. But of course, whether or not those Sanders supporters stay in the tent or leave the tent altogether and go sit at home, that's something that we have yet to see and something that concerns the Democratic Party.
Thanks, Tom, for the call. Reed Wilson is with us, national correspondent at The Hill. We're looking at yesterday's Super Tuesday voting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of how the Democratic field narrowed down in the last few days? Do you have thoughts on Mike Bloomberg out of the race? Elizabeth Warren still in the race, but reportedly reassessing her position there. What do you think? Sanders, Biden, whether you're a Democrat or watching from outside the party, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Reed Wilson from The Hill, talking about yesterday's primary elections that gave former Vice President Joe Biden a lead in pledged delegates over Senator Bernie Sanders. Reed, let's take a break from those two for a minute and look at some of the other candidates. One of the big questions for Super Tuesday is, okay, former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, he skipped the first few. He put all of his money and a lot of it into these Super Tuesday elections. And it didn't come out so well. What happened?
Not so well at all. Bloomberg won about one-tenth of the number of delegates that Joe Biden won last night, and he decided that was the end of his viable path to the Democratic nomination. So earlier today, Mike Bloomberg dropped out of the race. His strategy really reminded me of the last time a New York City mayor played a big role in a presidential primary, and that was back when Rudy Giuliani ran. In 2008. And at that point, Giuliani sort of left Iowa and retrenched in New Hampshire, then left New Hampshire and retrenched in South Carolina, and then left South Carolina to retrench in Florida. And he never actually like put all his chips into one basket and ended up by the point that everybody got to voting for him when he was really putting some effort into it, other candidates had momentum. And I think that's what we saw this time. If Michael Bloomberg had been on the ballot in South Carolina, maybe Joe Biden would not have had such a big win, and we'd be having a different conversation. In fact, if Michael Bloomberg had not qualified for the debate in Nevada at the last minute, thanks to an NPR poll that put him over the threshold, he wouldn't have been eviscerated by Elizabeth Warren, and maybe we'd be having a different conversation today. But the fact is, Bloomberg started leaking support after that Nevada debate. Biden took perfect advantage of it with a big win in South Carolina, and now I suppose the rest is history.
And now,
well, history yet to be written.
True. Now, Senator Elizabeth Warren still in the race as of today, but she also didn't hit, I think, even the expectations of her campaign and the outcomes yesterday.
Yeah, Warren has underperformed in virtually every contest she's been in. She has not finished better than third place. And even in her home state of Massachusetts, she finished in third behind Biden, who won the state, and Sanders, who came about 5 points ahead of her. So it's not good for a presidential candidate when they don't win their home state. And this probably forecloses her opportunity to make it to the convention as well. As a matter of fact, her campaign was even forecasting the fact that her best chance was through a contested convention as a sort of unity candidate. But now with about the same number of delegates as Bloomberg has, her path has probably closed as well.
Now, some Bernie Sanders supporters have said she should drop out of the race, or they were saying this before Super Tuesday, actually, and throw her support behind Bernie Sanders. Her voters would naturally go to Senator Sanders. I've seen some analysis from pollsters saying not necessarily. It could be something like half and half or 60-40 Warren supporters going to Sanders versus Biden. Of course, we don't know that because we haven't tried it yet. What are your thoughts on that, though, Reid?
Yeah, I don't buy that Warren voters would have gone en masse to Sanders. And frankly, I don't buy the notion of anybody playing the spoiler role when there's no clear frontrunner. I mean, before yesterday, you know, Sanders had a 6-delegate lead over Biden. That hardly makes him a clear frontrunner. But in talking to voters around the country, and I was in Iowa 7 times over the last year. I got pretty close to the border with Wisconsin, but never quite over the border. One of the things I heard repeatedly was voters struggling with a decision between Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, or Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar. So just because Warren seems to occupy that liberal lane with Sanders, that's not how voters actually saw it. That's just sort of the media shorthand that we all gave it. Voters who wanted to back Warren may have just as much affinity for Joe Biden as they do for Bernie Sanders. I don't think it's clear that Warren voters would automatically flock to Sanders if she were not in the race.
One other note on who voted yesterday. Younger voters apparently didn't turn out from the early analysis here. When they did, they went more for Bernie Sanders, but we didn't see them showing up en masse to the polls. What do you make of that, Reid?
Yeah, one of the things that we saw yesterday in most of the states is that Bernie Sanders won voters between the ages of 18 and 29 by about a 2-to-1 margin over his nearest rivals, and Biden was way far back. Biden was not one of those nearest rivals. But those voters only made up about 17 to 20% of the electorate, depending on which state you were in. Meanwhile, Joe Biden was getting in the mid-40s, about a 2-to-1 margin over his rivals, among the voters who are over 65, and those voters made up a quarter or if almost a third in some states around the country. So clearly, there's a generational fault line in the Democratic Party right now, and the older generation shows up to vote a lot more. The younger generation doesn't quite yet. Now, I'd offer a little bit of caution on those 17% and a third numbers. Exit polls are not great at finding the exact demographics of an electorate, so it may be the case that more younger voters are turning out. And in fact, I think we can say more younger voters are turning out now than in previous primaries, but that's a pretty low bar to clear.
Talking to Reid Wilson from The Hill, looking at some of the big news in national politics, mostly Super Tuesday today. But Reid, in our last few minutes, I want to switch gears. You wrote a book that we've talked to you about, Epidemic, about Ebola and the effort to prevent its spread. Well, now you're watching, I know, federal efforts to contain coronavirus, a very different disease, obviously way less lethal to those who get it, but maybe faster and sneakier at spreading. What kind of things are you watching for as the federal government responds here?
Well, I'm watching the way that they're actually talking about this virus. And one of the things that we've seen in previous viral outbreaks, whether it's H1N1 or Ebola or something like that, is that the federal government does best when they communicate clearly about the risk that the virus poses to the general public. So it's not realistic to say that this virus will not spread around the country. It's already spreading in communities in Washington. I mean, there's a case in Wisconsin. It's spreading in California and places like that. It is incumbent upon the federal government to make clear that this virus very well could impact a lot of us. However, it is not as deadly as the Ebola outbreak or anything like that. In fact, its mortality rate is pretty low. It's multiples more than a bad flu season, but a bad flu season kills 1 in every 1,000 people who get the virus. So people need to know how to take care of themselves, how to prevent the spread, and some simple steps they can take. You'd be amazed how many people can prevent themselves from getting sick, whether it's this virus or any other, from simply washing their hands regularly. And as much as we tell our toddlers to wash their hands, we should be doing that too. So it's incumbent upon the federal government to make that communication very clear and to focus less, frankly, on containing a virus and more on mitigating, more on testing everybody they possibly can to make sure that anybody who needs help gets treatment fast. That's the best way to keep the tragedy of death as low as possible.
And an event like this is also a test drive for our public health infrastructure. So far, this is probably early days, but what are we learning about the health infrastructure we have in place?
Well, it looks okay for now, but that's because there are not that many cases that have required medical attention in the United States. There have been 10 deaths now, 9 of them in Washington State, 1 in California. Actually, we may be up to 11. Excuse me, it's 10 in Washington, 1 in California. But what the public health officials were telling me over the last couple of days is that they are not trying to stop the virus. That's not realistic. And it's not a good use of their resources. They're trying to slow it down so that that health infrastructure you talked about, the hospitals and doctor's office, aren't simply overwhelmed with patients. And some governments are doing something pretty interesting. King County, Washington, which is the epicenter of the U.S. debate right now, is trying to buy a hotel where they could house patients if there's a widespread outbreak. So this is going to take some creative thinking. There are good, smart government officials who are doing that creative thinking, and it's incumbent upon all of us to do those basic things like washing our hands so that we can slow down the spread of a virus so that the people who really need the help get it.
Reed, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You got it, Rob.
We've been talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. He was with us mostly to break down the results of last night's Super Tuesday primaries and look at the race going forward. He's also the author of the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. We checked with him on coronavirus and government efforts to contain the damage from that illness. By the way, if you still have thoughts on the primary race after Super Tuesday, where do you fall on the question of whether the Democrats should nominate a self-declared progressive or a more moderate candidate? If you're a Republican voter or independent, what's sticking out to you about the race? If you're planning to vote in Wisconsin's primary next month, haven't made up your mind, what are you watching for? Let us know what you think. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can also follow coverage at WPR.org/news and watch stories as they pop up from WPR and NPR over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, and you can share your thoughts there too. We talked yesterday about science fiction and sociology and how science fiction can inform us about the real world. Some of you shared thoughts in the Ideas Network Facebook page. Pete mentioned one TV show, the Hitchhiker episode of the original Twilight Zone. I feel like that one was secretly directed at me because I saw it at a too young age. And to this day, I have to not think about that episode when I get in a car and look in the rearview mirror. Now, a lot of people have that kind of story of something scary they saw at a young age that stuck with them, including Judith Sears Poisson. Hey, Judith.
Hey.
So what was your scary thing that you saw too soon?
So I actually have two. So the one that really sticks out in my memory is I was on vacation with my parents, and it was somewhere, we lived in Chicago, and it was somewhere near the Mississippi, I know. I remember doing stuff like that. We were in a motel. My parents fell asleep. The three of us were watching something. I was definitely under 10. I'm guessing more like 8. And whatever we were watching ended and The Shining started. And I just started watching. I didn't know what it was. And I was so petrified that I literally could not move to even wake them up.
Wow.
So it was terrifying. The other thing was also very young age, probably about the same. I was allowed to watch something called, I think it was called The True Story of Frankenstein. And there was a scene where a hand had like come out of formaldehyde and was walking across the floor. And I did not sleep for 3 nights, nor did my mother. But now I love horror.
Okay, so it's not the stuff of nightmares to this day for
you?
No,
I love it.
Excellent. Judith, thanks a lot.
Sure.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.